Hello, and welcome to When Belief Dies and to another book review. Today I'm reviewing The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. I'm going to give you a bit of an overview to the book and then we're going to go into some quotes, but before I do, I think it might be helpful just to kind of give you a little bit of an overview of the author himself. So C.S. Lewis is a very well-known, if not potentially the most well-known, 20th century kind of apologist or layperson theologian who dives in and dabbles within Christian theology and begins to write books that are really influencing and challenging the people of his time, and still today are quite renowned within Christian circles, especially for being very influential, and within sort of atheistic, agnostic circles for being more frustrating than anything. I've read, just before this one, a couple of other C.S. Lewis books. So I read The Problem of Pain, which is kind of C.S. Lewis's attempt to explore the idea of suffering and evil within the world. And then I also read Mere Christianity a couple of weeks ago as well, which is C.S. Lewis's expression or, I guess, involvement within Christianity and his way of processing and thinking it through. So he's not, he is himself a Anglican. He's not trying to set the Anglican agenda up, but rather he's just trying to explain what Christianity is to a wider audience. Anyway, C.S. Lewis himself was born in 1898 in Belfast, and then he died in 1963 in Oxford. This book itself, The Great Divorce, was actually published in 1945, written during the Second World War. Mere Christianity, the other book I mentioned before, was actually originally four addresses released on the BBC, which is the British Broadcasting Company. They basically produced this as a way of helping people to find meaning and spirituality within the kind of events of the Second World War, and then that later became the book Mere Christianity. But this book itself was much more written during the actual time where World War II was taking place, and obviously published right near the finishing months of the war itself. I want to give an overview of the book now, because the quotes I'm going to read are going to kind of just be, I guess, highlights upon the sort of broader narratives of C.S. Lewis's book. So within The Great Divorce itself, essentially, what you have is you have a, let's call them a protagonist. I'm not sure we ever find out their name, really, who is essentially in hell. They have wandering some streets. They've been there for a little while. They are coming across bookshops with the windows kind of drawn and the lights on, but no one answering the door. They've come to good stations where there's tons of things that need to be delivered, but there's no train or good vehicle in sight to actually be able to take these packages to where they should be going. There are houses, but these houses are rickety. They're old. They're falling apart. There's water coming through the roof. The roads are sullen and dull and nasty and grimy and gritty. It feels like it's almost about to become nighttime. Like it's the last few moments of dusk, but it never does quite become nighttime. And everything isn't quite right. There seems to be a sense of dread and unease. And the characters that the protagonist meets whilst he's down in hell are grumbling, they're grumpy, they're frustrated. They're all very inward looking and focusing. C.S. Lewis himself explores some of the different ideas behind these characters in the book. Eventually, a few of them manage to get onto a bus and essentially make their way to heaven on this fantastic bus journey. They arrive there and they're instantly greeted by various, let's call them full humans. There are individuals that have passed away and gone to heaven and are now living in the fullness of God and his light and his certainty and his blessing and his joy and his love and all the attributes that Christianity associates with God. As these ghosts from hell have come on this bus into heaven, they're interacting with these individuals, and throughout the conversations, you see some of them become slowly more and more like the full men that they're interacting with, and others become lesser and lesser and more ghost-like, and some rush back to the bus, some disappear entirely. The idea, again, is C.S. Lewis is trying to explain that it's the individuals and the choices and the thoughts and the ideas and the actions they've made and have which are slowly leading them towards their final destination. It's a classic trope. It's the idea that hell is locked from the inside, that God isn't saying, right, you're going to be damned, you're damned, you're damned, you're saved, you're saved. But rather, it's the individual choices, even after death, which dictate where they belong in the end. Lewis is very careful, mentions it a couple of times, not to take this book as literal or to take this book as his theological outworkings of what he believes hell is going to be like. Rather, he's just trying to explain that for us today, the decisions and the ways that we act and the ways that we think, even if no one knows about them, things going on in our head and our heart, they affect who we become in the long run. As little little decisions become bigger habits, and those habits form character, and that character ultimately really dictates who we are and how others view us. And for C.S. Lewis and others that believe in eternity, that character continues on, and it still allows to chase its own dreams and desires. So I want to read a few quotes from this book that kind of highlight what I've just said. That's the sort of overarching thing. This character goes to heaven. He interacts with individuals. He understands and experiences and explores the concept of what heaven means and what hell looks like and what it means to be fully human, if the fullness of human is to be found in the person of Christ. So let's start with quote one. So this is from the preface. I do not think that all who choose wrong roads perish, but their rescue consists in being put back on the right road. A sum can be put right, but only by going back till you find the error and working it afresh from that point, never by simply going on. Evil can be undone, but it cannot develop into good. Time does not heal it. The spell must be unwound bit by bit, within backward mutters of dissevering power, or else not. It is still either or. Either we insist on keeping hell or even earth, and we shall not see heaven. If we accept heaven, we shall not be able to retain even the smallest, most intimate souvenirs of hell. I believe, to be sure, that any man who reaches heaven will find that what he abandoned, even in plucking out his right eye, has not been lost, that the kernel of what he was really seeking, even in his most depraved wishes, will be there beyond expectation, waiting for him in the high countries. In that sense, it will be true for those who have completed the journey, and for no others, to say that good is everything and heaven everywhere, but we, at this end of the road, must not try to anticipate that retrospective vision. If we do, we are likely to embrace the false and disastrous converse and fancy that everything is good and everywhere is heaven. There's a few points in that I just want to highlight really briefly. The idea that time does not heal evil, and actually that it needs to be unwound and unspun and loosed from the individual almost. He's obviously alluding here to the death and resurrection of Christ and how evil was conquered on the cross. It's a really fascinating kind of idea that evil in, if somebody chooses to purposely go down evil, they will continue on. And he mentions here that if we insist on keeping hell or any individual moment or focus within our life that we know to be wrong and we want to hold on to this over and above a relationship with God, then we won't be able to get heaven. We can't keep any souvenirs and get to heaven. The other bit, which I found really interesting, is to say that those things that we most desire within our lives that we're trying to hold on to, which might be the hell within us, if we do sacrifice that for that relationship with God, and we recognize that actually we can find fullness in the person of Christ, that actually in the high countries, as Lewis is talking about here, those things are brought to their most full, that actually the depraved ambitions and drives that we have now will find their fullness and correct course in the God-man, Christ. It's a really interesting opening to the book. I'm going to move to the second quote now. So by this point, essentially, the protagonist has arrived in hell. They've seen interactions between ghosts and full humans. They've explored and experienced. They can't quite walk on the ground. They found that everything's too hard. It's almost like because they're ethereal, they're unable to press into the ground. So they're hobbling around on grass or trying to walk on or by the water and finding that it's like liquid to them, liquid lava and pushing them, or liquid rock and pushing them away, and nothing works quite right for them. Everything seems to be so much more full and so much more correct, and it's so much more obvious how lesser than fully human these individuals are. So in this section, the protagonist is being, I guess, guided or escorted by a guide, to a fully human guide to different conversations to talk about different things, and here we have the sort of fully human individual relaying to our main protagonist. You will understand that better, perhaps, before you go, he said. In the meantime, I must tell ye They have come further for the sake of the ghosts than ye can understand. Every one of us lives only to journey further and further into the mountains. Every one of us has interrupted that journey and retraced immeasurable distances to come down today on the mere chance of saving some ghost. Of course, it is also a joy to do so, but ye cannot blame us for that. And it would be of no use to come further, even if it were possible. The sane would do no good if they made themselves mad to help madmen. But what of the poor ghosts, who never get into the omnibus at all? Everyone who wishes it does, never fear. There are only two kinds of people in the end. Those who say to God, "Thy will be done," and those to whom God says, in the end, "Thy will be done." All that are in hell choose it. Without that self-choice, there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek find. To those who knock, it is opened. When I went to Bible college, there was a real desire for universalism to be true. So universalism is the theological concept where, in the end, every soul saved, regardless of the decisions and circumstances and individual actions that they made within their life. This was quite a popular view as well during the time that C.S. Lewis was writing. And here Lewis is trying to express that, and he goes into more detail later in the book, which I won't spoil. It's definitely worth reading for yourself. But he's trying to express here that if you were to make a decision to focus and spend your life going down a direction that you realize is not going to lead you to the fully human state that you should be in the end, it will be allowed. You will be allowed to continue down that path because free will enables the sovereign individual to make that decision and to continue on. I really find it quite moving here when he says that no soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will ever miss it. Those who seek find, to those who knock, it is opened. And he kind of alluded to in the last quote as well that there are things within us that are desiring a satisfaction, whether that's financial satisfaction, and actually we can wind that back to being comfortable and happy in the here and now where we are, or maybe it's a success in career, being noticed, notoriety, being famous, and we can link that back to worth and value. There are so many things in our life that we desire, and quite often how we outplay that desire isn't healthy, but the actual root of the desire, the thing that was first within us before it became depraved, is actually a full goodness. So if that thing you're trying to seek is joy, what Lewis is trying to say, at least I think, is that that will be found, but only found in the purpose of everything, which again, these fully humans are telling us is further up and further in, higher and higher into the mountains, into his domain. The last quote, I want to give a little bit of background to before we start, but before I do, I just wanted to ask a couple of questions. Well, I want to ask one question, really. I'm obviously currently reading, or have just finished reading, The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. The next book I'm going to read is The Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. I'm really excited to read that book. It's got a lot of interesting nuances, written during Soviet Russia, published after the author passed away. I'll obviously leave a book review for that, so don't worry. But the big question right now is, what book should I read next? I mean, I really would love to hear your reflections and thoughts on where I should go. There are loads of Christian books I want to read. There's quite a few atheistic books I want to read. There's loads of ancient sort of books I want to read as well. And I think it's just be helpful to get an idea from you guys what you think would be a useful book for me to pick up at some point in the near future that you'd like to see reviewed here on When Belief Dies. So leave a comment in the description here on YouTube, or if you're listening, head on over to YouTube, find the video version, and please leave a comment. Let me know a book you think would be good. I'll keep an eye out for those, and if certain books get a certain amount of thumbs up, I'll look at getting it. To be fair, if any one comment comes in with a book, I'll have a look at it anyway. But I'd like to hear you guys and what you want, and then if you could look at the description or the comments even, if somebody said a book you think would be good, give it a thumbs up, give it a comment, help me to know what I should be going to next for the book reviews. The version of this book, this actual version itself, The Great Divorce, I'm going to do a similar thing to last time. So if you're willing to support When Belief Dies, if you like the work I do, if you like these reviews, if you head on over to Patreon, the link's in the description, and if you sign up to become a monthly giver of When Belief Dies, once you've signed up, if you go to the direct messaging system there, the DMs, and you find me, I'll be there straight away. Make sure you leave the words "The Great Divorce" in the DM section, and I will basically put everybody who does that, their names into a hat, and I'll draw one person. I'll send you this very copy of The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis. If there's just one of you, obviously you'll be the person who gets this copy of the book. If there are more than one, I'll let the winner know, and I'll let those who haven't won know as well. If you're in the UK, shipping's on me. If you're international, we'll have a conversation. We'll probably share the costs, but we'll figure something out to get this copy of The Great Divorce over to you for sure. So yeah, hit me up on Patreon, The Great Divorce. You could be in a chance of winning this book. If you like When Belief Dies, the final thing before we get to the last quote, if you like When Belief Dies, if you like these videos, if you're new here, hit subscribe, hit the notification bell. You'll be reminded whenever we release a video on When Belief Dies. And if you found this review helpful, please give it a thumbs up. It helps to boost it so that if somebody types in The Great Divorce book review, they'll come here, which will be really helpful for us and our stats and our listener base. Share it potentially as well with friends, family, or anybody else that's read the book or is thinking about reading the book. Just give them a bit of an overview of what they can expect and hopefully encourage them to pick it up, because I do think it's well worth it. Anyway, enough of that. Let's get to this last quote. So a bit of background before we get to this quote. What we've seen so far is this dwarf figure called Frank, who is so unhuman that he's morphed himself utterly and completely. He's holding a chain which is linked to a puppet, almost. He is linked to somebody who looks like a theatre actor. I imagine somebody with a bowler hat and a moustache and maybe even a cane and a monocle. You can imagine whatever you want, but that's what I think. Somebody who is a, ha-ha, good to see you, oh, lovely to be here. That sort of proper British accent in the theatre back in the day. Anyway, a full human, we only know her as the lady, is talking to Frank. Not this puppet, or the tragedian, as they call it, but actually, Frank is this dwarf, misshapen figure holding this chain, trying to communicate, not himself, but through the puppet. And during the course of the conversation, he's realised that this lady is correct, but the puppet is consistently pushed back against him, and he's become smaller and smaller and smaller, and the puppet is still there, the same size, but he is no longer visible. And we start this conversation here with the lady trying to talk to Frank while searching through the ground. "No, Frank, not here," said the lady. "Listen to reason. Do you think joy was created to live always under that threat, always defenceless against those who would rather be miserable than have their self-will crossed? For it was real misery. I know that now. You made yourself really wretched. That you can still do. But you can no longer communicate your wretchedness. Everything becomes more and more itself. Here is joy that cannot be shaken. Our light can swallow up your darkness, but your darkness cannot now infect our light. No, 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 come to us. We will not go to you. Can you really have thought that love and joy would always be at the mercy and frowns of sighs? Did you not know they were stronger than their opposites?" "Love, how dare you use that word," said the tragedian. At the same moment, he gathered up the chain, which had now for some time been swinging uselessly at his side, and somehow disposed of it. I'm not quite sure, but I think he swallowed it. Then, for the first time, it became clear that the lady saw and addressed him only. "Where is Frank?" she said. "And who are you, sir? I never knew you. Perhaps you had better leave me, or stay if you prefer. If it would help you, and if it were possible, I would go down with you into hell, but you cannot bring hell into me." "You do not love me," said the tragedian, in a thin, bat-like voice, and he was now very difficult to see. "I cannot love a lie," said the lady. "I cannot love the thing which is not. I am love, and out of it I will not go." There was no answer. The tragedian had vanished. The lady was alone in that woodland place, and a brown bird went hopping past her, bending with its light feet the grasses I could not bend. It's a very powerful book. I was talking to Kirsty, my wife, about it, and I said it's almost like a horror novel. If it's true, it's freaking scary, man. Thanks for watching. Catch you in the next one, all right? Cheers.